Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. We are joined this morning by Moving Melvin Brown, a man, a magic, a music or music. He is going to be performing this weekend and next at the San Francisco Fringe Festival. Good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about your show. You sing and you dance and you've traveled the world and seen some great reviews of your performances. Tell us a little bit about your performance and sort of how it came about.
Okay, well, this show, as you said, is called A Man, A Magic, A Music. And it's basically a journey through Black music history from the 50s, starting the 50s to the 90s. And what I do with the show, I take you on a trip to the life of the country, my life, and the life of music. And, you know, there's three separate parallels that I cover at the same time. So, you know, in the beginning of the 1950s, you know, like the first time I ever saw a black man on television was, you know, Bill Robinson, Bojangles, tap dance. And so I do a Bill Robinson tap dance routine. Then I move into the 50s and, well, I tell how I actually got into music because I grew up, you know, when I grew up, and we went to church every Sunday, and of course, in church, everybody sang. You know, it's like, okay, if you go to church, you sing. It was just like normal thing then. And, actually decided that, okay, I'm in entertainment the first day of school. The teacher asked if anybody could dance, and I thought, well, what kind of question is that? Everybody dances, you know. That's what I thought, you know. And she said, Melvin, come and dance for her. Well, I did a little dance. Everybody clapped and yelled for me. I thought, you know, at that point on, I knew exactly what I wanted to do with my life, you know. I was an entertainer basically from that point on. And, you know, I went through the 50s when they started to play black music on the radio. And, because, you know, before 55, basically they can hear black music on the radio. And they started to play black music. And I go to the artists who were kind of breaking the line, you know, like Chubby Checker, The Twist, and you know, people like James Brown, Otis Redding, Ray Charles, and you know, I go to all of the artists, and of course, I work with a lot of people. You know, I open shows in Cincinnati for a lot of these people because Cincinnati at this time was like the hub of black music. So So I have a lot of information about the way the lives were going on with these people, and I tell the stories, and I give some insight into what was happening, you know, because when I reached a teenager, you know, I was running, hanging out in the nightclub, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and they were dangerous places at this time, but and of course, how my mother and father was trying to keep me out of these places, but it's like, you know, I was determined to be there. And of course, in these places, you know, I mean, people were coming through, like, you know, Wilson Pickett, B.B. King, all these kind of people were coming through this place to sing. And of course, you meet some of the best musicians. I mean, these musicians that came to these places were people who they got up in the morning and, you know, got a cigarette and they started working on the instrument, and that's all they did. So, I mean, so they were playing music that was just amazing stuff, you know. And, I was looking at all of that. And basically, I go through all of the music and looking at all the stuff that was happening. I did a stint in the military, and of course, and I tell about all of the discrimination that went along in the military, and how I almost got hung up in the Vietnam conflict, but because of the discrimination, they decided, we don't want this guy anywhere near us in Vietnam. The problem. So I tell the story of how I got out of the military just when the Vietnam War was starting, and all the ramifications of that story, and it's a lot of humor. At the same time, it's reality, but it's humor in the sense that you realize that how people can be this way. And at the same time, I'm having to navigate my way through all of this to keep on doing what I want to do, music, And of course, back when the riots were going on, all these people, Stokely Carmichael, H.R.A.P. Brown, Malcolm X, and all these people, I was in the midst of all of that, So I give insight as to the way I seen all of this going down and what I was doing as far as musically at this time and what the country was doing, what was happening in the country, the change that was going on in the country. So I give the stories of that. And then, of course, after my military, with my own show band, traveling the country, and opening shows for different people, James Brown, B.B. King, and of course, Lionel Richie and the Commodores were just a young group that opened for my shit. They opened for us,
Wow, and, really?
Yeah, and... And we got, we had a hit song in the Southern United States, and it played up well. And after this time, we had problems with the group, so I left the band, and then I started working with a dance group. And I worked with the dance group for about 7 years, and it was a whole different thing happening there, I give the story of the insight as to how, you got people on the road trying to make this happen, and they're still, instead of this late date, we're still facing a lot of discrimination and problems. You can't get places to stay, you can't find places to eat decently, and of course, I give insight as to how this was happening, but all in all, with all of this, you have to figure out how to survive and to make your life keep working for you so you can keep what you're doing. then after the dance group, I did a comedy about 3 years with a comedy and I give them some of the understanding of how that worked and some of the craziness that went on with that and. But then after the comedy team, I decided that. I did another record about this time after the comedy team. I was like, okay, I'm an entertainer. I'm a singer, dancer, and tap dancer. It's okay to do comedy, but that's not my thing. So I went back to singing and dancing as a single act and. So it started working out really well at that point. And I recorded a song, and it's funny that that song that I recorded, they picked it up. And so someone picked it up and started playing that song in London about 2 or 3 years ago, and it went way up on the charts in London, on the jazz charts. So basically, they're trying to find me, and I'm traveling all over the world by now, doing my thing, because I was getting booked into a lot of festivals, and And I gave insight as to how this began because I could get hard in the festival. That's when I, basically, that's when I first started really to tap dance because I never tap danced before. But, you know, the guy wouldn't harm me because he's like, well, you know, we have singers, we have dances, but, yeah. But when I say tap dance, he thought, oh, it's great, you know. So he harmed me in the festival. And then I learned how to really tap dance. But I had to do this in like 6 months' time. And I did the festival. You know, I did, started doing the festival. And the guy said, oh, yeah, that's great. You must have been doing this all of your life. Hey, yeah. And, but along with all this, you know, I give insight as to all the characters that I grew up with, like the black preacher. I give them a whole character run down as a black preacher, and you know, doing the sermon and the singing and the dancing, I did a James Brown character, and I created a lot of different things in the shows myself, like robotic dances and. And of course, I had to go through always go through stuff that Michael Jackson and do a Michael Jackson thing also.
Mm-hmm.
It's a show that basically the story is as the lady said in Edinburgh, that's one of the biggest festivals in the world, and they give you a 5-star rating. And the lady said, "Yeah, I was just completely blown away because I never seen anything like this in my life, and I never heard stories like this." And because there's so many great stories that go along with the songs and the dancing and the tap dancing, one of the questions I always get at the show is these things really happen in your life, or is this something? And I had to tell people, no, this is reality. This is what really happened, And when I look back on all these things that happened, I realized that about every 10 years, I was like kind of reinventing myself into something new and a new avenue of entertainment. But it was surviving, up until now, of course, I jump around. I do a lot of the big festivals around the world, and I've had a couple of other songs that are on the charts. But I'm doing the festival is a way for me to do something that I didn't do before, to tell my story and to give people real understanding of what really happened. And how really black music came into its own, and the people that brought it into its own, and the things that they had to go through to get there. But at the same time, I kept a good sense of humor about it. I realized, that if you get hung up in this, you're gonna go down, So I didn't get hung up in the hatred. Animosity and the anger, I just basically was there and keeping a sense of humor, I can live with this because, and I tell stories like my mother would always say to me, look, life is what you make of, that's kind of something that took me through all of what I went through to do entertainment because it was like, when you were dealing with people, you realize, okay, look, I can get involved with this foolishness of what they're doing, or I can stay with myself and come from where I'm coming from to keep everything going for me. Because if I get, you get hung up in the racism and discrimination stuff and the anger takes you down, And so I had to keep dealing with that in a way that I stay alive and keep my life going for me, but at the same time keep my career working. So it's a grand story, I think. And it's a real story.
Yeah, yeah, it sounds like a really grand story. So you were you born in Cincinnati, Ohio?
Yeah, I was born in Cincinnati, Ohio. And one of the things is that, you know, when I was in Cincinnati when I was born, you know, it was still, even though it was, you know, Cincinnati was right across the bridge from Kentucky. So, you know, in Kentucky was basically, you know, slave, you know, one of those slave states. And Cincinnati and Ohio was basically supposed to be one of the free states. But, yeah, I mean, but the discrimination, that was just ridiculous, you know, when I was coming along. I mean, you know, we may not have had as some of the people in Mississippi, Georgia, but it wasn't good either.
Wow. And so many of these musicians that you said you opened for, some of them are no longer with us. And
yeah,
so
yes,
the story you're telling like a first-hand account of these artists, you know, legendary artists whom, you know, we can only access them through people like you who actually encountered them and worked with them and knew them. So I'm sure that's another really wonderful aspect of your show, you know, that you are keeping alive this history.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's another thing also, is that a lot of people don't realize that, you know, just about, you know, black music, soul music, they, you know, today, a lot of people don't realize where, you know, how all of this began, because, you know, in the early 50s, you know, you only heard, you know, some rural country music or classical music on the radio. That's all they played on the radio. But then, you know, around 54, 55, they started easing in some of the soul music and stuff, and then it just took off. You know, it took on a life of its own. And America didn't have rhythm before this. I mean, you see, now you look around, you see people singing, dancing, you know, with rhythm. Yeah. Back then, you know, it was only black people doing this, you know, and we introduced this rhythm and this music and rhythm singing to the world, basically, and you see the legacy of all of that today, you know, but a lot of people don't understand where it all came from and how it began, because they, you know, they just see it today and they think, well, okay, yeah. It's always been this way in America, you know, that the people, you know, just sing and dance and have rhythm, but it hasn't always been this way.
Right. And then that whole story you tell about the radio and then, you know, particularly the story of black radio and how, you know, black radio differed from, you know, the mainstream stations with regards to the programming. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, about radio. And also you mentioned that you had some hit songs. I was wondering if you could maybe tell us the names of those songs and tell us, you know, sort of some of the songs that you're going to be performing,
yeah,
you know, that are your original pieces.
Yeah. Well, the radio station in Cincinnati, the first radio station I remember in Cincinnati, and actually, later was a little bit later in the later 50s, was bought by James Brown, was owned by James Brown. But, you know, they, the first radio station called WCIN out of Cincinnati, Ohio, and the guy was like a hip radio station, you know, and the guy was like, yeah, this is your soul. This is the radio with the bug scrubs, the man with the plug, you know, one of those kind of things, you know. And but it was, you know, of course everybody listened because that was the only black radio station that you could hear, you know, hear the music on, you know. And because the white radio station, even when they started to play the music right away, a lot of the white artists started to record the black song. And they wouldn't play the version, the black version of the song. They would play the white version of the song, and they wouldn't say anything about who recorded the song, you know. So the music was just being, you know, pirated back then. It was just, and the radio station back then, the white radio station back then, was a part of the fact of just stealing the music and you know, away from the original artist. And of course, like a lot of people think, you know, the songs like Unchained Melody that I do on the show, a lot of people think that they don't realize that Roy Hamilton originally recorded this song, you know. And of course, I did the Roy Hamilton version of Unchained Melody, and a lot of the early songs of Ray Charles, and of course Otis Redding, James Brown, and of course the song that I had was called "Send Me Some Love," that became a hit that I wrote, but it was with my band, and my band was called Moving, Soothing, and Stone Funk Band. and the kind of band we had, the show we had, was kind of a Sly and the Family Stone type guy. You know, that's when, you know, back then the funk was coming in the 60s, you know. So everything was funky, you know. Yeah. And we had, you know, everybody, you know, we showed up on stage and we had outfits. We changed. We did four different sets and had four different sets of outfits, and everybody, when they got on stage, everybody was dancing and singing. You know, it was like one of those Sly and the Family Stones type deals, you know, the funk within. Mm-hmm. And of course, the Ohio Players, I mean, we traveled with them for a long time doing shows, and we traveled with the Manhattan doing shows with them. Mm-hmm. And there was just so many people that I ran into. And, of course, we used to open for, they used to have the Battle of the Blues, and I think it was a place called Dothan, Alabama. And they had the Battle of the Blues every Saturday night, and they'd have B.B. King and Bobby Blue playing the Battle of the Blues, you know. And we'd open the show for these guys, you know.
Wow. Yeah. Talk a little bit about, you know, these artists. You know, granted, you said, you know, you were really young, you know, opening for them, but you're still here. And let's talk about your longevity, because I hear that the entertainment industry, it was really difficult. You know, you mentioned not having a place to stay, you know, because of segregation. So it was really difficult being on the road. But then it was also difficult because in the industry, there were a lot of crooks. People were robbing the artists of their royalties and, you know, sort of stealing their assets. And a lot of times because maybe the artists didn't have, good legal representation, or they just didn't know. Talk about, you know, sort of the business of music and your longevity, you know, as a person and as an artist. So you've been doing this for a long time. If you started as, you know, a youngster, you know, a teenager, professionally.
Well, it's like, I think to explain the artistry of it, it's like, I think Ray Charles said that, you know, there are people who, play music for money, and there are people who make money while they're playing music, you know. And I think, and he said, those are the real artists, you know. and it's true, and that's why the system were able to take advantage of a lot of the black artists back then, because, you know, some of them, you know, started to wise up, you know, and realize, hey, you know, I've got to be a businessman and an artist, you know. And they had to, you know, there was people like Sam Cooke who realized, hey, I can do both these things. I have to if I want to survive. So he does his own recording company, his own publishing company, and everything, so he could keep his money himself, you know. But but the thing was, and it's something that a lot of people, I don't know if they realize, is that people did music and were doing music and because that's what they love to do. Yeah. And they just wanted some way where to do it and some place to do it, you know. And of course, you know, the people were taking advantage of that, you know. It's like, hey, you know, we'll give you a place and we'll help you find, you know, do the music. But you sign these crazy contracts where everything you're doing, you know, the money's coming to us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, there came a time when the people started to wise up, you know. But so many of the great artists that, you know, that lost their rights to their music, and some of these people, you hear some of the stories where some of these people wind up, you know, broke and dying with nothing, you know, but like I'm saying, that's the basic truth was for all of that was that, you know, the people were living the love of what they did. They loved the music. They loved to do the music, and they just wanted a place to present it, you know, so that people could hear it and they could do it. You know, the concept of how you turn this into a business wasn't a great concept for those people at that time. You know, they just knew how to sing, they knew how to dance. They know how to entertain, and they love to do it, and they get it,
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. So I want to let our audience know again that we're speaking to Moving Melvin Brown, a man of magic music, and he's performing, he's one of the opening performances at the 22nd Annual San Francisco Fringe Festival, which starts today, and it runs for 14 days, 2 weeks, September 6th through 21st. At the Exit Theaterplex, 156 Eddy Street in downtown San Francisco. You can take BART there and just walk up the block. So you're performing this evening, and also you can visit sffringe.org to get all the details or call the hotline at 415-673-3847. So Mr. Melvin, so you're performing tonight. What time is your show at the Exit Theater?
Tonight we're on at 7 p.m.
7, okay.
Yeah, and then we're on the 10th, and the 10th, the 11th, and 12th. At 7 p.m. on the 10th, and at 9 p.m. on the 11th, 9 p.m. on the 12th, okay. And on the 15th at 8:30, that's our last show, on the 15th at 8:30.
Okay, great. So people can return to see you more than once, huh?
We've had people. Well, it's like I was saying about the lady who wrote the review in Edinburgh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I went to that show, there was over 1,500 shows in that festival, and they said, okay, we're going to review this show. What she thought? Okay, well, she told me she thought, I'm really tired. I could only get an 11:30 at night slot on this festival. And then she said, it's late, I'm tired, I don't want to do this, but she said, it's my job. I'll go in, I'll get through this, and I'll write the review, you know. And she said she came in, and she said she was just completely blown away. She said she'd never been through something like this in her life. And she wrote a 5-star review, and of course, we had people sitting on the stage for the rest of my run. Yeah, I mean, we couldn't get people in, enough people in the stage. Of course, I went back to the same show the next year, and it was sold out when we got there. And we have people that come, you know, one time, and then, yeah, if I'm at the festival, like we were at the festival for 4 weeks, we had invite people to it three or four times at the show. And it's like, oh, it's such a great show. I just wanted to, I just wanted to get it all in my system. Yeah.
Nice, nice. Yeah. Well, maybe you know, next time, maybe we can have you on again. Since you're gonna be here for a while after I see it, I'll come in this evening, and we can have you on again and play some of your music. That'd be really super.
Yeah, that would be great. And you asked me about my songs. I have one song called Love Stormy Weather, and that's still, you know, on the soul. They have these soul music clubs around the world, and it's, you know, really, really high on the soul music chart. A guy said to me, he says, I tried to get a copy of that Love Stormy Weather. He said they wanted £1,000 for a copy, but I can't pay that kind of money. so that was a song that that I wrote, I mean, at least 26 years ago, and it popped up on the charts in London. They started playing and people started loving it, and it started their life all over again, But today, today I've got a new song that was just released called the T.I.H. Dance, and it's because I do tap dance workshops all over the world, and we call them T.I.H. Tap Dance, Tap Into Health. T.I.H. is Tap Into Health, but it's a tap dance workout workshop. And we'll be doing probably one here before we leave. We haven't got it all lined out. But the people come in and they learn something about tap, but it's a whole workout and health system based around tap dancing, And that's something that works really well. And the people, they come and we've done it in the places that we travel to, and they people just, it's like, oh, it's something great. Because most people that I meet always said, I'd love to tap dance. I always thought about how great it would be to learn. But most people think, it seems so hard to learn. But I have a method of teaching tap dance where everybody can do it. And we've had children as young as 8 years old and people as up to 80 years old in my workshop. And everybody does it,
certainly let me know. Have Francesca let me know when you figure out what the date is for the workshop and the venue, so I can let people know.
We sure will. And,
that's really great. Maybe I can come if it's a time when I'm not working. That would be really great to come to a Tap Into Health workshop.
Yeah.
That would be really super. Are you going to be selling your CDs at the venue this evening and at the other performances? Will people be able to buy your records?
Yeah, I have CDs available. I have the book available.
Okay.
I have a book that this is actually, I'm working on my third book now. I have my book available. It's called As a Man Thinketh. And because, throughout my show, I give these little tidbits of wisdom about life and how you survive and everything. And people are so infatuated about that, and that's why I decided, I'm going to write this book, So I wrote the book called As a Man Thinketh, and it has a whole understanding of how you basically live, survive, and navigate your way through life and make life work for you instead of you working for it,
Right. Well, that's great. We'll definitely love to have you on again. So I was wondering, in closing, since, we just passed a really monumental anniversary in American history, the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, and I Have a Dream speech, and your show, through music, through art, you tell the story of this country. I was wondering if you have any thoughts on that anniversary. And what you were doing at that particular moment in time.
That was the time when I was in the military. When the riots broke out and I was in the military in 64, 65. I got in 65, and of course I tell this was the time when the Kennedys got killed, you know, Martin Luther King got shot, and the Vietnam War. So and these were sequence of events happening at that time. And of course, in the March on Washington, you know, I was in the military when this happened. You know, and I mean, we were having a terrible time. Even though you're in the military, supposed to be protecting your country, fighting for your country, you didn't have rights.
Mm-hmm.
So the March on Washington, you know, I mean, it was like, it was a big thing, you know, to look at, you know, during this time. And in fact, I was in the middle of this country making one of the biggest changes that it made in the history, I think, you know. And you know, I was in the middle of that, you know, and you know, the black people, you know, it took a lot to survive to get through this because, you know, you had to keep your head intact, you know, and realize, you know, yeah, okay, I gotta navigate my way through this, you know. And of course, people like Martin Luther King and Stokely Carmichael. I mean, these guys, you know, even though like they were in the different ballpark, but they were playing the same game, you know. And Malcolm X, I was listening to these guys, you know, the things that they would say, and the media, you know, hearing them. It helps you understand. Okay, we can make it through this. We can deal with this thing and get it on the right track. But you know, you got to get your thinking in, and that was the message from Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and people like this. You know, you got to get your brain in gear and keep it moving. You know, and then you can do this and come out on the other side. So it was so inspirational for me. These people, you know, making that happen. You know. In fact, I have another show that I do. You know, I started to write these musicals as another way of moving around the world to tell my stories and to get people to understand about the music. But I have another show called Soul to Soul, I Have a Dream, which I did a song. I Have a Dream called I Have a Dream, and it's based along the line of the speech that Martin Luther King gave. But I put the whole lyrics to that thing myself. And it's a story basically of music also. But I start with this when the slaves came to America, and I started to tell the whole story. So, you know, all of this was, you know, Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and these people, they were so inspirational in my life in realizing that, you know, these people were at the forefront of bringing black people to a decent level in America, you know. And it was amazing to be there and be a part of the transition and watching it change at the same time. It was an amazing thing to be there, you know.
Wow. Well, I certainly would love to have you on again and talk more about your soul-to-soul work, as well as, you know, listen to your I Have a Dream rendition. That sounds really wonderful, sort of telling the history of our people from Africa to America. And then our survival, you know, like, okay, what happened after that? Sounds like the current show, right?
Yeah.
So you're telling, you know, you're a historian, you know, using your music and art and dance as a way to record this history so it doesn't get lost. That's really excellent.
Yeah. Well, it's basically.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, basically, I always felt like that I was born with a talent, you know, and I realized that, you know, the real gift of life is to share your talent with the world and to help, you know, to help the world. It makes the world a better place when you share your talent with it, because you help people to be happy, but you help them to understand also. And, you know, I feel very fortunate to be able to do that, you know.
Right. Yeah. Well, thank you again so much for joining us, Mr. Brown, and I look forward to seeing your show this evening and having you on again before you leave this area. So you take good care and have a good rest of the morning, and I'll see you this evening.
All right. Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it. Okay. And look forward to seeing
you. All right.
You
take good care.
All right.
All right. Bye-bye. Good morning, Jahan. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you so much for joining us, you know, on opening night day to talk about Legally Blonde, the music, Legally Blonde, the musical, which is, I guess, is it closing the Woodmaster Summer Musicals 2013 season?
Yes.
Yeah, and I didn't realize that Woodmaster Summer Musicals is having its 47th anniversary this year. 47 years of musical theater under the stars in beautiful Joaquin Miller Park in Oakland. And it is really beautiful, and you were fantastic in your various roles last night at the preview. It was a very full house, and we just had a good time. It was so wonderful.
Great. That's awesome.
Yeah, and so I didn't know the story. I heard of Legally Blonde, but never really wanted to see it. And didn't know it was a movie, and so happy that Tessie, your cousin, invited me out, and, you know, I go anywhere with Tessie, and so it's like, oh, yeah, theater. Joaquin Miller, nice. Jahan did it. Oh, that's even better. Yeah, I had never seen Hairspray, the other musical that we drove to see you in, until you were in it. I've never seen the movie, never seen the play, and it's been, you know, and so you just really exposed me to a whole lot of theater that I had never thought about going to see. The story didn't seem that complex or involved or deep, and in both instances, like Hairspray, you know, quite a good story, and Legally Blonde, what a wonderful story about a young woman who is allowing her love for a man to, a boy at that time, or a man, to keep her from realizing her full potential, intellectual potential. She's just sort of going on her looks, and didn't really, I mean, she knew she was smart, but that didn't really matter. And love takes her to law school, where she meets a man who helps her value her true potential. And that is just really wonderful. And your characters, you just play a range of wonderful characters, ending with the judge, which is, like, really cool. So talk to us a little bit about the play and what drew you to it, and this particular, is this your first time at Woodmaster? Have you performed there before?
No, this is my second time performing at Woodmaster.
Okay.
I did a show there in 2011 called Finian's Rainbow.
Mm-hmm.
This is actually my second time doing Legally Blonde. I did this show a year ago in Walnut Creek. And it's such a fun show, and it actually has an incredible message about being true to yourself and, you know, not letting anyone tell you you can't do something. When you believe in your heart, you can. And it's so fun, and doing theater in an outdoor space is interesting. But wonderful, because it's so beautiful outside.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember the first time I did a show there, I was just terrified of bugs flying in while I'm singing. But no, it's great. I love it. I love the show. It's so fun. It's incredibly funny and has a wonderful message. And it's fun for the whole family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is. I just love the choreography and the dance numbers. I mean, they are huge, as in Broadway stage huge. Talk a little bit about the director, your, you know, the cast, you know, because you actually lead a solo. And Tassine was like, oh, Afro-Haitian, you know, you go Jahan, wow. you talk a little about, you know, the wonderful music, because there's a live orchestra in the pit. I'm like, whoa, man, I never knew that the Whitmister Summer Musicals was of such high caliber of theater. It's really, really very well done.
Well, yeah, it is a professional theater, and it's run by a family, actually. So Harriet, the woman who runs the theater, her son directs, Joel, and her daughter Jody is the choreographer. And they're great.
Oh.
And Jody is just, I love her so much. She's so funny. And she's tough, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, obviously there are results, so. She must know what she's doing, right?
Yeah, you all are good. So she, I don't know, if she's tough, she must be, I mean, she's very good and tough because, I mean, the choreography is, some of the numbers are huge. Like, for instance, when the lead character realizes that she has to go to Harvard, and I'm thinking, okay, you know, she's from the valley. Oh, my phone is acting crazy. she's from, you know, the valley, and they have money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Talk a little bit about the character and how she has to prepare herself to go to law school.
Oh, so it's she realizes that this guy who she's wanted for a long time, who's suddenly dumped her because she wasn't quote unquote serious enough, she realizes she needs to be serious, so she needs to go to law school as well. So she works really hard and she passed her LSATs, the requirements to go to Harvard Law School. And as a part of her application, instead of a personal essay, she decides to appear live. And she invites all her friends from UCLA, including the band and the cheerleaders. And it's a huge, huge number. And it's a lot of fun, a lot of fun. And I'm actually not in that number, but when I did it a year ago, I was in it. And it's so fun.
Oh, you were? Oh.
Yeah.
So when you did it a year ago, you were a member of, you were one of her friends, and so you were performing all those numbers where her friends come to her as, like, the Greek chorus, where you were in all those?
Oh, no, I actually wasn't in the Greek chorus. I was just, I was in the band in that particular song when she goes to the Harvard.
Okay. Yeah. I thought it was, you're also at Harvard. You're one of the students. You're in the cafe or the restaurant when, you know, she wears this new dress. What's the character's name? Who's the protagonist in Legally Blonde?
Her name is Elle Woods.
Right, Elle Woods. And and you're sitting there with your friend, and you all just texting away. I'm like, look at them. They're not even talking. It's really funny.
I know.
Yeah, Yeah, and then I really love the costuming. It's so lovely. Who does the costuming? I mean, Elle Woods is just so into pink, and everything is pink, from shoes to purse to bags. I mean, and the pinks have different, like, casual pink, dressy pink, you know, formal pink. I mean, but it's all pink.
Yes. In this show, there's a lot of pink. So you have, if you're not used to a lot of pink, you got to get used to a lot of pink, because there's a lot.
Yeah,
it was great. The costumer, she actually made some of the pieces. So they were working really hard, you know, for her costumes because she has so many. Elle, she has a lot of costumes. And actually, she has to have a dresser because she's on stage so much and she has to get dressed so quickly. So I just wanted to give a shout out to Natalie LaFong for being an awesome dresser for Elle and really quick.
I mean, there are so many like little, you know, sort of places where the story goes in and out of Valley Girl, you know, fluff to really deep, and then keeps it moving, because you know, Elwood, I saw her, you know, her father, you know, is wealthy. They live in Palm Beach.
Malibu.
Is it Palm Beach? Malibu. Malibu, sorry. Malibu. And I guess that's a place, because she says, you know, she tells us at one point who her neighbor is a place where a lot of wealthy people are. So her father, you know, he didn't have to get a scholarship. You know, he could afford to send her there, you know, to Harvard if she passed, you know, the LSAT and got in. And, and you think about sort of on another level, what Harvard material looks like. And she, you know, with her little dog and all her pink, they're like, And her inventive personal essay, which is a personal essay where she is the essay, you know, it's quite different. Yet the folks that are in charge of, you know, new admissions decide to go with it, right? She charms them because she's doing it for love. She wants to win her boyfriend back and let him know that, you know, hey, I'm there's more going for me than my body and my looks.
Yeah.
And so, and she did graduate with a 4.0, right, from UCLA?
Correct. Yeah.
Go ahead, Jihan.
Oh, I was gonna say it's just a little, you know. She's actually very bright, and she's probably one of the brighter girls in her sorority, and she's a 4.0, and still it's not enough, you know? You know what I mean? Like, they still are judging her because of the way she looks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, you know, how, but her friends didn't, for a moment, think that she wasn't capable. They said, well, you want to go to Harvard? Then this is what you have to do. And they helped her. They supported her. Her little friend, you know, got the books, you know, got the test preparation. She took the test. Score wasn't high enough. And so they said, no, you can't go party. You can't go do this. You've got to buckle down and get serious. And that's a really good message for young women that don't think they're capable. You know, that you might not pass the first time, but you keep on working at it. You can pass. You just have to focus and be serious. And so then she gets in, but then she's still not serious. And then she meets another person that helps her through his story, shows her how they're both, you know, not on the outside. You know, he because of his poverty, and her because of her wealth and her looks, and just the attitude that, you know, person in pink sort of conveys, like, oh, you can't be smart because you wear pink.
Right.
But I really like the scenes where she uses what she knows to come up with creative legal solutions to what's going on, or I guess legal maneuvers to figure out to address what's going on in the case that they're handling as a class. That's really interesting.
What are some
of your favorite scenes? I really also like the hairdresser. Tell us about that scene, that particular character. She's great. There are a lot of stories going on, and that's one of the big stories.
Oh, Paulette, yes. Paulette Bonifante. She's great. She's a salon owner. She is another person who's been told, you know, she can't do things. She's, you know, not smart enough, this, she's that, and she's believed them until Elle comes and gives her a little boost of confidence, and she finally confronts her ex, who totally, he treated her terrible for 10 years and kept her dog, and she's so fun. She's such a fun
mm-hmm.
character. And her and this UPS man, who always comes in and has a huge crush on him, but she doesn't have the confidence to actually talk to him. And Elle and her Greek chorus help her to be able to talk to him. And of
mm-hmm.
course,
right, yeah.
Total plus.
Mhm. Yeah, that's really, really awesome. I'm trying to think. I was looking at Paulette, her name, and it says Bill Farner. But is that her name? I mean, Bill? Is that her name? Paulette's name? Linda Dorsey. Linda Dorsey.
Yes, Linda Dorsey. I was like, huh?
Yeah, I was looking at like, how could I see her? Her name is Paul. Okay, yeah, Linda Dorsey is Paulette, the beautician, and a lot of great scenes happened in there. Because she does a favor for Elle. Elle, who's played by Claire. How do you pronounce Claire's last name?
I honestly don't know how to say her last name.
Yeah, it looks like Buchanani, but I'm not certain. But when you look at your program, the tonight is opening night, you can figure it out. Because Claire is ready to change herself into another person, because she's thinking, I'm a natural blonde, but maybe I need to change myself up because, you know, I want to win my boyfriend back. What's her boyfriend's name?
Warner.
Okay, and Warner is performed by Daniel Mitchell. He's really good.
Yeah.
I really come to dislike him. He's a good actor.
That's good.
Yeah,
that's good.
Yeah. Very. I at the end, I'm like, oh, please, you know, go away. And then Elle, you know, it's really great the way she's so self-reflective, and you see her really growing and maturing, you know, over the course of the story, you know, from Malibu to Harvard and these different experiences she has, and then she realizes that her life has been one that has prepared her in some way for, you know, this new direction that she's taking. What's her the law clerk that she meets when she first hits Harvard that's really nice to her? What's his name?
Emmett. Emmett Forster.
Emmett's great. He's a really good actor. Isn't he? I mean, you can't read him. He's really good. Kyle Kane. He's a great actor. Do you know any of these this cast members from other performances, you know, throughout the Bay Area?
You said what? I'm sorry.
Do you know any of these, the members of the cast from other performances? Like, have you been on stage with any of them before this particular performance of Legally Blonde?
Yes, I have. I did 9 to 5 with Katherine Hahn, who plays EA Joyce Riley, and
mm-hmm.
I've done the show I did at Woodminster 2 years ago. I did with a few of the girls in here. The girls with
mm-hmm.
Chutney at the end. The girl with the perm, you know, and
uh-huh.
and a few of the Delta New girls.
Uh-huh.
I know a few people.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. That's great. So let me read your bio for folks, just so they can hear a little bit more about you. Again, you perform, you're an ensemble, you're the judge, and you're Paulette's understudy. Oh, you are. Wow, Jahan, let us know if you go on. I will totally come back, okay?
Okay.
Oh, my God, you're Paulette. That'd be really interesting seeing you as Paulette. The character. Okay, Paulette's character. Wow. Okay. And anyway, Jahan Kabir is super stoked to be doing Legally Blonde at Woodminster Amphitheater, originally from the East Bay. Jahan studied musical theater at the American Musical and Dramatic Academy in Los Angeles. Her credits include Rent, Hairspray, Once in this on This Island, Legally Blonde, Parade, Finian's Rainbow, and 9 to 5. And you're currently, doing auditions for the Book of Mormon, right? That's getting ready to open in the Best of Broadway in San Francisco.
Well, they're having auditions, I think, in a week or so. So I'm going to try and get
and
out.
You're going to be auditioning, right?
Yes.
We might see you in this. You tell her, keep us posted. And, so I'm really, really excited about that. So tell us about, your stage career and what took you into theater, specifically musical theater, which is probably a little more challenging than, theater that doesn't involve singing and dancing. Because you have to sort of be a all-around actress to be able to do all those things well.
Well, when I was a kid, I liked singing, around, but I never really took lessons or anything. And I went to the YMCA, and we created a choir, like a children's choir, that we sang
mm-hmm.
in when I was about 7. Or 8, and I did that, and then for years I didn't do anything until I got to high school, and they had theater, and I was like, yes, I want to do it, and I was in theater, and I did show choir, and we performed all the time, and I was in all my school musicals, and that's when I decided that, hey, I think I could do this for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
So I went
yeah.
to school for
wow.
it. I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What school did you go to? We hear a lot about the arts in schools and how important it is. And it sounds like your school, you were one of the lucky students that was in a school with an arts program. That's not the case for all children nowadays. What school were you? Did you attend? Was it a public school or a private school?
I went to public school. I went to Pinole Valley High School in Pinole,
okay.
California.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And, we were lucky. I'm actually really lucky because they had a conservatory program also. And actually, we were one of the last students to actually be able to participate in that because, budget and funds ran out. And so I'm not even sure if that program exists anymore. But I got to do conservatory. So I did children's theater classes. I was in dance conservatory. I was in, there was two choirs. There was an all-women's choir, and then there was show choir. I did both of those. It was great. That's the part of the reason I went to that school, actually.
Uh-huh. Wow, that's awesome. Do you ever go back and talk to the students at your school or other schools and talk about, musical theater and art, being an artist as a career?
I actually have not. I went up to my school probably about a year ago, and I did have a chat with the current show choir teacher, and he mentioned something about me coming and talking, but it just seemed like we never got together. So I actually haven't done that yet, but that's something that I would be interested in to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. So far in your theatrical career, tell us about some of your favorite characters.
Some of my favorite characters? Probably being a dynamite in Hairspray was super fun. the girl trio, the Supremes inspired trio.
Yes.
That was really fun. I also loved doing Rent was really fun because it's such a close knit. Like everyone is doing everything in that show, so you get really close with the cast.
Mm-hmm.
But I like that sense of community. And, I actually did a cabaret in the city last year, last November.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really fun because I got to play myself.
Oh, okay. That's funny.
Right.
Yeah. That's funny. You
know,
yeah,
that's funny.
Pleasure. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I would have loved to have come to that and missed that completely. Yeah, you got to put me on your email blast when you're doing things, locally and, regionally. I was just thinking about back to Legally Blonde, the musical, which is, how long is it up? It opens tonight, and how long is it going to be at the Woodmaster Amphitheater?
It runs 2 weekends, so it's running the 6th, the 7th, the 8th, and then it's running the 13th, the 14th, and the 15th. So it's only 2 weekends,
okay.
And they're all night shows because it's just
mm-hmm.
too hot in the day to be outside. But all the performances, the Friday and Saturday performances are at 8 o'clock, and the Sunday performances are at 7. So
okay.
the 8th and the 15th, they start at 7.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So Thursday night, last night was special. It was just special because it was the preview, and so the show doesn't – there's no Thursday show next week.
No Thursday show, no.
Okay, we were lucky. Okay, nice, nice. And again, you can go to Woodminster, WOODMINSTER.com, or call 510-531-9597 for tickets. And the Woodminster Amphitheater is located at 3300 Joaquin Miller Road in Oakland. Really easy to find once you get on Joaquin Miller Road. Well, actually, once you get on, what's that street? Is that a mountain? What is the street that you're turning into? Is that Joaquin Miller, the big street? And then you make a left into the,
yeah.
Like you come up Lincoln. Is that Joaquin Miller?
Right, yeah. You go up Joaquin Miller, and then you make a left.
Okay,
the
yeah.
It's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and I'm sorry. I made a mistake. There is a show on Thursday on the 12th. It's at 7 also.
Oh, there is. Okay, all right. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Thursday night was nice. And because I don't know, if we thought we were supposed to pay, but we were going to have to pay for parking, but we ended up not having to pay for parking. People should also bring blankets and pillows to sit on and a flashlight because it's not that easy to see if you don't park in the lower parking lot. And parking, I don't know, we didn't have to pay for parking. Is that true for all performances that you don't have to pay for parking?
No, usually parking is $5. But I guess...
We got lucky.
Yeah, they didn't do it for the preview.
Okay.
So it'll start today. It'll be 5.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there are refreshments, which is nice. You know, you can get beverages, you can get popcorn. You can also bring food. So it's just a really, really, really nice nice way to spend the evening with friends and family. But I wanted to ask you, going back to Legally Blonde, the musical, I wanted to ask you about, the character, the protagonist, and I'm trying to think, what was her name?
Elwood.
Elwood, yeah. And, you're a young African-American woman, yet this particular story, it certainly resonates. It resonated for me as a black woman, and I was wondering how it might resonate for you as a young black woman, this story, because they're, the protagonist, Elwood is a blonde woman. She's from a privileged family. But the story actually sort of transcends those particular details. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that as a young black woman. And, if you want to personalize it as well, you certainly can, because people might think, Legally Blonde, oh, no, don't think it's for me. I was like, yeah, it really is for you. You really can learn a lot and enjoy it in the process by, sort of taking this journey with Elwood you know, into her life and sort of beyond whatever, you know, because she would have never imagined that her life could be what it is at the end of the play if she hadn't had that heartbreak.
Right. Exactly. And, yeah, I totally identify, you know, as a Black woman, there's a certain perception of who you are or who you should be. And, you know, I try to keep it positive, as they say in the show. And I try really hard not to let people define who I am. And I do what I want to, and if I want to do something, I will do it. And I have the confidence. If I can't get something that I want, I know to go ask someone to help me to get something, you know, that I need. And it's just, especially in my, the profession I chose, where you're constantly being judged, you really have to have a strong sense of self, because it's very easy to listen to those people, you know, telling you, you can't do this, you can't do that. And to totally break down from it. But, you know, it's okay if you break down from it. It's how you get up, you know, after.
Right.
That really Yes. So it's very inspiring, you know, for anyone. You're right. The story does
And, you know, it's really interesting how, you know, the shows that make it to Broadway are musicals, and people think of musicals as entertainment, you know, for entertainment's sake and not being that deep. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about the sort of the comedic form, because, you know, you're a scholar, you studied this, so you know a little bit about, a lot maybe, about the theatrical form, particularly the one that, you know, has became, you know, American theater, you know, sort of hallmark. And I wanted you to talk about the form of the musical and the form of the comedy, yet couched within the form, you know, is there usually a message? And the message, is the message usually deep, like the one, you know, that we experience in Hairspray? Because I'm just seeing you, you know, in that particular play, and which is a musical, and in this latest one, Legally Blonde. Could you talk a little bit about the form that this particular theatrical story takes?
Well, in theater and in any musical comedy, which not all musicals are comedic, that's definitely a common misconception. There are musicals that are not very comedic, like there's some comedic relief in it, but they're not comedy. But the comedy always has a purpose. Everything has a purpose. Nothing put in by accident. Every joke, every line, every punchline has meaning, and the meaning behind it to the bigger picture. And I think, you know, with most art, whether it be theater or movies or whatever, there is a message, you know, someone's trying to convey. And usually, like, especially in the case of, like, Hairspray, for instance, that had a huge message, you know, racial inequality in it. And I think that with musicals, I think it's just an easier way to deliver such a deep message, you know, to do it comedically, because, and to relate it to things that people understand. And I think it's just a fun, easier way to convey something deeper. You know, sometimes just beating, you know, beating over people's heads with, like, this, it just doesn't work, and people don't respond to that, you know. And either comic relief, people can relate to that, you know, all these different situations, and it's good that, you know, people can laugh about maybe not the best situations in their life. I think it's just an easier delivery process for those kinds of things. And
right, yeah. Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, I was thinking when you said that, I was thinking about some of the musicals, like the one, the Scottsboro Boys, which I didn't think worked well in that form. That was here a couple of years ago. I'm like, oh, no, this is not working for me. And it was not just a musical, it was vaudeville at that. It's like, oh, heck no. Did you get a chance to see the Scottsboro Boys?
I didn't. I missed that. I was doing a show when it was here in the city.
Oh, okay. Well, you might have gotten angry, so it was okay. I was wondering, in closing, if you could talk a little bit about some of your favorite scenes, and then I was just thinking as you were talking about coming up, you know, in this particular art form, theater. I was wondering, in Legally Blonde, one of the parts I really liked are the sort of the Greek chorus. And then when the Greek chorus, which is, you know, Elwood's friends, but they're not with her physically, they're with her spiritually, and then they're with her physically. I want you to talk a little bit about your quote, Greek chorus. Like, who is with you? Who's got your back? Who is always present with you, particularly in situations where, you know, you could go one way or the other, and you take the higher road, so to speak.
My spiritual guide, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think my spiritual guide, as you call it, changes, I think, for every situation. I have different inspirations, you know. Sometimes it's my grandmother. Sometimes it's my mother. Sometimes it's, you know, my favorite teacher from college who told me, mm-hmm. you know, who gave me great advice. Or sometimes it's me, you know, telling myself, you know, mm-hmm. you can do this. You got this, you know. Just leave, you know, you came here to show them what you can do. Just show them, leave them a gift and walk out. Don't think about it, you know, those kinds of things. And I love the Greek chorus in this show too. It's just, it's so true, you know, those conversations you have in your head.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, you know, it's those things when you're in those situations and you're going through these conversations in your head. And mm-hmm. I think that's what the Greek chorus represents, and they're awesome. I love them. Actually, one of my favorites I love Take It Like a Man, where she gives him the makeover. And
mm-hmm.
obviously, I love the courtroom scenes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
especially
and then when you all travel to the bathroom, I just love, I mean, I never knew that about permanence. You know, when you get your hair relaxed, and you're sitting on the toilet in the bathroom, you know, that's your new courtroom scene. You know, sit seat. That's
right.
A really great scene.
Really, yeah.
Great scene.
It's so funny.
Mhm.
Yeah. It's great.
Mm-hmm.
I love it.
Yeah. Right. Well, I want to thank you so much again for joining us. And, really looking forward to maybe trying to get back and see you again in this particular production. And certainly encourage everyone to get on by the Woodminster Amphitheater for its, what year is this for? It's 47th. Wow, that's amazing. 47th year of musical theater under the stars. I mean, that's significant. I mean, it's almost 50.
Yeah.
That's been going on for a long time. And I saw some people in the audience that looked like they had been coming since they were children.
Right.
And now
yeah.
they're grandparents. I'm like, wow.
I know someone who actually graduated at that theater. Their middle school graduation, I believe, was at that theater.
Mm-hmm. Wow, nice. And then it's the same place where they have, you know, the summer music, the music on Sunday is continuing, so they have, like, wonderful concerts there in Woodminster as well on Sundays, and it's continuing through, I think, I'm not sure about October, but definitely through September. So, yeah, it's all Parks. You know, that's a part of the Woodminster, is a part of Parks and Rec, Oakland Parks and Rec. So glad that, you know, in the various tax cuts that this particular program didn't get, you know, go on the chopping block.
Right.
Do you have a website, Jahan, that you want to share with people so they can keep track of you? Because you're just all over the place.
Actually, I don't have a website.
Not yet? Okay.
No.
Yeah, should they find you on Facebook or something, or what?
Yeah, they can find me on Facebook. Jahan Sabir, mm-hmm. JIHANSABIR. I should be the only one on there, so.
Right. Well, we were really proud of you last night, you know, seeing you on stage. It's like, oh, that's our niece or, you know, cousin. I'm like, oh, she's just so good. Yeah, really, really fine performance. You're just excellent. And I'm saying that, you know, with bias and without bias. You're just good. I'm sure they'll be calling you back again because you really make the production quite wonderful.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. So you take good care. I'm going to let you go and have a good opening performance, and looking forward to seeing you again on stage.
All right. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. You take good care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye. So again, that was Jahan Sabir, and she is appearing in Legally Blonde, the musical, which has a two-week run opening tonight at the Woodminster Amphitheater. It's part of Woodminster Summer Musicals 2013. It's the closing musical, and it's running for 2 weeks. And so we're going to close the show with a rebroadcast of a wonderful interview with Denver Reen, who was at the Room last year in June 12th and 17th, and we just had a great conversation. So we're going to close with that particular interview, and don't forget Mr. Melvin Brown, you know, who's opening tonight at the, I think, 22nd Annual San Francisco Fringe Festival. Don't want to miss her. And then Regina is also going to be, her performance about sexual trafficking is also a part of this season at the San Francisco Fringe at the Exit Theater Complex, which is on Eddy in San Francisco. Alrighty, so looking forward to another edition of Wanda's Picks on Wednesday morning. Until then, have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. And we're so happy that the hunger strike, which was going into its 62nd, 63rd day, has ended. I'm not sure of the details yet, but you can go online probably at sfbayview.com and get the details there, or online at the website for the hunger strike in California's prison system.
What would I like to know? That is so cool. Well, gosh, maybe we should talk about what's bringing you out here to San Francisco. You've got a new CD and you've got a new show, and maybe you could tell us about what you're bringing to the Razz Room June 12th.
What I'm bringing to the Razz Room?
Yeah. What a
greatness.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Give us some details. Who? Because I think you're bringing a band, right?
Yes, I am.
And some new material?
Yeah, some new material, and, you know, I'm working on a show that I'm taking to Broadway.
Mm.
So I'll be working on that there, and so it's going to be exciting.
Oh, so you're going to test it out on us. That's great. We love that. Okay. So you're going to be, I believe, sort of bringing back some old favorite tunes and honoring some of your favorite folks. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oldies but goodies, yeah.
Oldies but goodies. You know, people that, you know, that we grew up with and have touched my life, you know, people I've worked with.
mm-hmm.
you know, Sammy Davis, Frank Sinatra, you know, people
yeah.
like that, Bob Fosse, Tom O'Horgan, you know, and Hair. I did Hair, matter of fact, right there in San Francisco.
You did?
The Orpheum Theater, yeah.
Wow.
I came up some time ago, and I found, I discovered a guy named Michael Philip Thomas.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And he was doing Burger, so I hired him in Los Angeles, and he hurt his back. And so they called me to come up to the Orpheum Theater to cover for him.
Mm.
And that's when we, you know, we really got to be good friends years ago.
Mm.
And then I was at the On Broadway Theater where there's No Place to Be Somebody, Charles Gardone's play.
Mm-hmm.
And so San Francisco and I have a history.
Yeah.
I lived in Berkeley for a while.
You did?
Yes, I did.
Wow.
Matter of fact, there was a guy named Wasserman, I believe. And he wrote an article on me. I did my first concert at the On Broadway Theater in those years.
Yeah.
And got my launch there.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Wow. So you have some dear memories of the Bay Area.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Oh, that's
dear,
wonderful.
Dear memories.
Wow, that is so awesome. I was reading your lovely, but I just love that caricature of you on your website. It's so cute.
Well, thank you.
And then your photographer, you got some great photographs, you know, when they're sort of, you know, going through the... you know, sort of showing you the different looks of Ben Vereen.
Yes, yes.
Those are really
Thank
nice,
you.
Too. And you've gotten, like, what, 10 doctorates?
Is that right?
Yeah, I'm like, well, you're like...
Out of them.
Yeah, wow, I was like, so wonderful. And I was looking at one was from the Medgar Evers College there in
Medgar Evers.
Yeah.
Yeah,
is that in Brooklyn? No.
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
Brooklyn.
It is Brooklyn, right.
Mm-hmm.
And they sponsor... A ritual every year, the second Saturday in June. It's called Libations for the Ancestors, and it's an international pouring for our ancestors that died or made that passage, you know, during the European slave trade. And
really? I didn't know
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. And so, and it's a really
well,
old
I'm honored.
Celebration.
I'm honored.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and I thought, wow, how fitting, you know, sort of looking at, you know, your really famous role in Roots. And I was watching some of the segments on Oprah's website. And,
oh, yes, when we did the reunion.
Yeah, yeah, and the part where you talked about how you really wanted to be in the film and how your agent was saying, well, you know, you're a song and dance man. They need an actor.
Oh, yes. Yes.
That was funny.
Yeah, I fired him.
Oh, good. You need someone with vision, for sure.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Yeah, and so I was wondering if you could talk about, you know, I was thinking, one, if we could start with, you know, that Chicken George character, and sort of, you know, your preparation, you know, within your life for that role as the child of a rape, and then, you know, sort of being known by that, you know, that bird, the chicken, which is used to venerate the ancestors, and you know, sort of stands for, you know, life, you know, fertility, because
oh,
every day.
You. Look at you. Look at you. You got it all down. You don't need this. If you read, just write it.
Well, you might not agree with me, you know.
Thank you, my queen. Thank you very much.
Yeah, but I just thought about, you know, sort of the whole renewal. And then within your personal life, you know, finding out that you have another family
mm-hmm.
after having
that
the one.
That was until later.
Yeah.
Years. My my baby daughter, Karan, came to me one day and said, Dad, you know, Mom has her history, but we don't, you know, you, and that's it.
Mm.
And I decided to go for my search. It's interesting that I did Roots, and I really didn't have any knowledge of my past until, you know, I went to Europe with Sammy Davis Jr., and he said, you know, you have to get a passport. And I went down to get a passport, and I found out that I wasn't who I was,
mm-hmm.
you know. And that's when my search began, you know. So for me, doing Roots was really interesting because I was doing a part of a story about legacy, but I hadn't found mine.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
So it was quite overwhelming. It was quite overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, yeah, I was wondering, so when you like you have, it sounded like you had a wonderful, you know, childhood and family that raised you,
Oh, you did. I did. Most
definitely.
Yeah. Love personified. Mm-hmm. You know, it was interesting because when I found this out, the woman who raised me, Pauline Green, mm-hmm. When I found it out and I came back from Europe and I looked at her, and she was really taken by this whole discovery because she would never wanted me to know.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at her and I told her, I said, "You're the only mother I know. You're the only eyes I saw when I looked up. You know, so you're my mom." You know,
mm-hmm.
And so we left it that way. That's what she came and she told me what had happened. You know, and she told me about my mother. And when my daughter said, "You know, Dad, we got to find, you know, who your people are," and we went looking.
Mm-hmm.
And I found them about 4 years ago, 5 years ago now.
Oh, it's been that recent.
Yes, it's been that recent.
Oh,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And this is an interesting thing, and I'm writing it in my book, is that they lived an hour. My mother, my original mother, lived an hour away from me, but she didn't know who I was. She went looking for me.
Hmm.
And when, you know, in 1946, when you say, you go to the police and say, you know, I've lost a child, they weren't interested, you know. I'm supposed to be an African-American woman, you know.
Hmm.
So she stayed there 2 years looking for me.
Wow.
And then she went to, she lived in Connecticut, 1 hour away from me. So
hmm.
You got to read the book because it's very interesting about how we got back together.
Yeah.
She's no longer with us, of course.
Right, yeah, she passed.
Yes.
That's amazing. Yeah, and so how did your mother, you know, your mother, you know, who raised you, how did they find you?
Well, it's a couple of stories. One is that my mother, it's in the book. Yes, read the book.
Okay, I will totally read. I'm not one of those people, you tell me the punchline and I don't listen to the joke.
Yeah,
you tell me the ending and I will still read the book. Don't worry.
Okay, wonderful. Well, what happened was, supposedly my mother, my birth mother,
yes.
was they met in a storm. And she was, supposedly, according to the story I got, she was homeless. And my mother took her to, the woman who raised me took her to her apartment.
Hmm.
And after I was born, she was sent, the woman left. But that wasn't the story that I found out.
Hmm.
And so when I found out that my mother actually left her with friends there, left me with friends in Miami, went back to look at my sister and brother to take care of her children she had prior to another marriage, and came back and I was gone.
Hmm. Oh,
so that's
okay.
That's the story I got from my family, from
right.
me, you know, the
mm-hmm.
Pearsons.
Yeah. Hmm. Wow, that's amazing. Yeah,
yeah,
and then your character, you know, Chicken George, you know, he goes away and then he comes back and
his family, and then brings his family to freedom.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. and then he tells his grandson the story of that first African.
That's right.
It's like coming full circle, and
right.
it so mirrors your real life, doesn't it?
Yes, it is.
I mean, it's like,
it's so interesting.
Whoa, what's going on here? You know, the synergy, you know,
yeah.
the serendipity.
You know, what's so interesting is that, you know, how I got that role.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, out of all the actors, because I wasn't an actor. I'd done Pippin, I'd done Broadway,
mm-hmm.
but I hadn't been in any films or anything like that. And it was fortuitous that the producer happened to be in the audience of one of my shows. I used to do a character called Bert Williams, who, you know, was one of our early performance great stars,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, suffered the ridicules of prejudice in this country. And, you know, he said, "Yeah, I don't mind being, you know, a black performer." He says, "But in America, it's an inconvenience." That was his line.
Mm-hmm.
And so I used to do a parody on him, which I got ridiculed for, you know, but I used to do a parody on him about the ridiculousness of what we had to go through. And I was doing it in Savannah, Georgia. And I looked up one day, and there was the producer, Stan Margulies, in the audience. And he saw my Bert Williams, and he came backstage. He said, "I want you to be my Chicken George." I didn't know who a Chicken George was or what a Chicken George said. We hadn't read the book. And I said, yes, because I'd heard about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, boom, and I got the role. And it was quite a journey.
Right.
Quite a journey. To this day,
mm-hmm.
we still talk about it. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's 30-some-odd years later, we're still talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, because it was for you. It was definitely for you in a lot of ways. I mean, and it's probably
yes.
becoming more and more
yes.
apparent why as, you know, you have, you know, as the years pass and the moments pass, like, wow, yeah. Because I was just thinking about when I read that story about Bert Williams and, you know, you're portraying him, and I thought about, you know, the minstrel tradition and
mm-hmm.
and the Scottsboro Boys, you know,
mm-hmm.
on Broadway,
yeah,
you know, as
yeah.
a musical,
yeah.
and reverse minstrel with the black folks wearing white face.
Yeah.
And then I don't know if you know this playwright, but you probably do. Her name is, because she's in New York, and you know the folks there, Dale Orlander Smith.
Oh,
you do know. Okay, well, she's at Berkeley Rep now, doing her Black and Blue Boys, Broken Men.
Beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. And I was just thinking about, you know, your humanitarian work and your lectures around around a lot of things about sort of things that encourage young people, particularly young men and women who might not have everything they think they need in their lives to be successful, you know, how to be resourceful.
Well, it's all within you, isn't it?
Mm-hmm,
it's just tapping within you. You know, we look without for everything, but we need to look within, because within is all the resources that we need. You know, recently my last grandchild was born.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Moses. And
Moses.
And
wow.
So I, you know, my daughter gave me my baby grandchild. He's 2 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember sitting in the room when he was born and put him in my hands, and I watched the pigmentation coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like Spirit was saying, if you need me, I'll be right in here, inside here. And we look outside for it, but within us is all that we need. Within us is legacy, and we teach from within without to go out. And then we have our legacy in us, and all that we need is in Spirit, within us. You know, and that's what I try to teach from when I'm teaching an acting class, or you know, teach seminars of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right. Yeah. But then, you know, you look at you know, characters that Dale paints in her current play that she's performing, and these children, oh my goodness, their parents are so broken,
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
these kids, I mean, they do look within, and
mm-hmm.
and they and some of them are able to do some really remarkable things, but then when they become adults, they're still broken. So
mm-hmm.
then they have flashbacks because of that
mm-hmm.
trauma. So what do you do when the support network is not there to help you realize that you need some help to become truly healed?
That you look within yourself,
but there's not enough there because you don't have the tools because you're a little kid.
yes. So around you, you know, I believe that, you know, we're surrounded by angels that support us.
Mm.
Look, I was a kid from Brooklyn. I'm a kid from Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and all probability, I should not be who I am today. But one day, I'm standing on the street corner. And I'm doing my kid thing. I was about 6 years old, 6, 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And this gentleman comes walking down the street, you know, my white brother, you know, comes
mm-hmm.
walking down the street. Out of all the kids on the block, he points to me. And he says, is your mother home? And he was a talent scout. And
mm-hmm.
I was playing stickball. I wasn't dancing or singing.
Mm-hmm.
I was playing stickball.
Yeah.
The destiny.
Huh.
And I went upstairs. My mother said, I want him to go to do a dance school. She didn't know nothing about the theater. Take him.
Mm-hmm.
Take him, because I want him to have something better than what I've got. And that's how my journey began. It's like, it seems like Spirit calls upon that which will make us who we are today if we're open and receptive to it. But how do we teach that to children? When they, you know, they're from families that do not have the resources to believe in themselves, to know that it's going to be all right because they've come to the planet to make it better. How do we give them those resources and teach them that? You know, we teach them how to make a living, but we don't teach them how to live.
Mm-hmm.
You know, churches are doing the best job that they can, you know, by relating, you know, well, you know, things are going to get better, you know, when you get to heaven. You know? But what about bringing heaven to earth?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what these children come. They bring us heaven by just being here on this earth. They bring a baby, a child born is heaven on earth. And then we educate them.
Yeah,
we mess enlightening
them up. Yeah,
you know,
mm-hmm.
enlightening them. You know, so I try to, in my teachings, is try to touch that within them, to let it express itself, and from that basis, that's where I work when I teach classes,
mm-hmm.
within out, not from out in.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you could talk about, you know, your attraction to storytelling, via performance art and. Yeah, and how you used, you know, your personal journey to inform your ethos?
To excuse me?
Your ethos.
My ethos?
Yeah, your ethics, you know, your principles, you know, how... Yeah, because, I mean, you have a really extensive and long and very well decorated, you know, insofar as all the different kinds of awards one can receive and honors one can receive, you know, career. And you're still going strong. I mean, like, seriously. So, you know, a lot of times people don't last in the business of entertainment because there are a lot of distractions.
I feel blessed.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say it's something greater than myself.
Mm.
Without myself, I probably wouldn't get out of bed in the morning. So something greater than myself makes me get out of bed in the morning. Something greater calls me,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I just have to give honor to that within me, you know, that which keeps me going. As long as I'm here on this planet called Earth, you know, something within me greater than myself is the reason why I do what I do. And I give honor and praise to that. Call it God, Allah, Jesus, Elohim, Yahweh, whatever you choose to be divine. It works.
Right. Yeah. So this attraction to storytelling. You tell storytelling. You tell stories.
I do.
Yeah. And yeah, talk about that storytelling. I mean, that's real basic to the human, you know, species.
You know, Alex Haley was a storyteller.
Yeah.
You know, I just tell stories of my life, and hopefully somebody will be inspired.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the stories that I have to tell. And so I tell from a place of knowing. And in doing so, you know, somebody says, I get it. And then I feel that my job is being done. When I do my show and doing songs, I try to tell the story that is personal to me. And somebody out there is having a similar situation.
Right.
And they can go, oh, I get it. And so that's why I love what I do. Because I'm able to touch people as they touch me.
Mm-hmm.
It's a give and take sort of show. We share.
Right. Yeah.
And I've had some wonderful mentors. Along my path, you know. So I'm just, and they're still coming.
Mm.
They're still coming, you know. And I get to share with people. I get to share with people like Usher. I get to share with people like Terrence Howard. I get to share with people that, you know, Big Boy and, you know, and those guys.
Mm-hmm.
I get to share with the young people today.
Right. Right, yeah. I was reading Harry Belafonte's memoir, which is, that's an endeavor. I don't know if yours is like 700 pages long. Is your book that long?
Well, it may be long. Maybe one page.
But it was a fabulous journey. My song and in his book, I just love these type of journeys because he's lived long enough for it to be, you know, sort of really epic. And so you're reading a history book as lived by this person. And similarly, when one reads your book, you know, as you're writing, one is going to be reading a history book through your life, which makes it a lot easier to remember because we'll be identifying with you. And we like you, so we'll remember the details.
Thank you, my queen. Thank you.
Yeah. So why don't you tell us about, give us some stories. I mean, you know, you've had like some of your mentors are no longer with us, and some of the folks you hung out with, Gregory Hines, Sammy Davis Jr.
Gregory.
Oh my
Gregory.
Goodness, they're not with
Gregory.
Us anymore.
Yeah.
Nina Simone, you know.
Yeah. Well, Gregory.
Yeah.
Gregory. I went and saw Gregory and Jelly's last year.
Mm.
Prior to it was 92, when I had we're 96 when I had my accident, and when I came back, you know, started working to get myself back at Kessler back east, up in Jersey, and it was my birthday that year, and I wanted to see a show, so I said I want to see Jelly's last year, and I went to see the show. And Gregory and Savion Glover and the cast just did a magnificent job. And after the show was over, you know, Greg was standing there taking his bow. And he stopped his bow, and he said, he introduced me in the audience. And then he came up and he said, listen, Ben, if you can get ready, Keith David is leaving the show. Come this way.
Mm.
Come this way. And at the time, I could hardly lift my leg. I mean, I had a trach. And they had taken my spleen. I had a broken leg. I had a stroke on my right side. He said, if you can be ready, come this way. And I got there. I opened that show.
Wow.
I opened that show. And people and the doctors would say things like, you know, when I first had the accident in 1992, had the accident, the doctor said, it's going to be at least 3 years before you'll ever walk again. Hmm. And as far as his career, I think he should think about another career. So when he sent the occupational therapist to work with me on my motor skills, I didn't know what an occupational therapist was. Mm-hmm. I thought they were people who showed me how to get a new job.
I thought so too until right now,
no? Occupational therapy. Occupation, right?
Right.
No, show me how to get a new job. Because he's telling me, my doctor's telling me, you'll never work in show business again. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had a trach. You know, I took my spleen. Mm-hmm. I had a broken left leg. I had a stroke on my right side. I mean, that was done.
Yeah.
But the letters and the prayers that came through were amazing. Mm-hmm. They gave me encouragement. You know, and then Gregory said, come this way. And that was a green light.
Mm-hmm.
And 10 months later, after my accident, I walked on stage in Jelly's Last Jam.
Wow.
And all the doctors who said it would be 3 years before I'd walk again and get my career, mm-hmm. they were sitting in the audience with their mouths gaped open. And Lexus sponsored my comeback.
Mm.
And it was packed. The place was packed.
Wow.
Packed. In standing room.
Yeah. Had you been driving a Lexus when you had the accident?
No.
Oh.
Mm-mm.
Okay.
No, I hadn't.
Mm.
I was driving a Corvette. And they didn't sponsor me, so I don't drive Corvettes anymore.
Yeah, they should have like sponsored you totally. It's like,
yeah.
Yes. Wow, that is amazing, though. So I guess that sort of really shows a person that if you have something to strive toward, it makes it, I mean, the journey was difficult getting from being injured to becoming, you know, well enough to be able to do what you loved again.
Yeah, you know what it was? For my, you know, usually in program, the playbill, mm-hmm. you put your bio, right?
Right.
So when they asked me what my bio, I said, for my bio, put footprints.
Mm.
So those who are reading,
nice.
When they see me on that stage, they know how I got there.
Yeah.
You know the story of footprints, right?
Yeah.
It was that within me carrying me.
Mm-hmm.
It was the God of my understanding carrying me.
Right.
And when I was going through all the turmoil and all the heartbreak and all the broken body and my world was torn apart,
mm-hmm.
and I turned and I said, well, you know, you promised you'd be with me when I got into this journey. You said you'd always be with me. He said, when you went through that whole thing, it was me carrying you through the storm.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't of your own cognizance. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, so I give praise and thanks. Praise and thanks.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And then your daughter. One of your daughters was in a really horrific car accident,
yes,
right?
Yes, I lost a daughter.
Was that before yours or after yours?
Yes, before mine.
Oh,
mine.
Wow. Yeah.
That took me on a spin.
Mm-hmm.
That took me right out. It's still this day, you know, I've learned to live with it.
Mm-hmm.
Any bereaved parent out there knows, you know, you learn to live with it, but you never get over it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a part of your heart that's open. There's a hole.
Mm-hmm.
There's a hole there.
Right. Yeah. Mhm. Right. Wow. Yeah. I was again looking at your wonderful website. and I wanted you to talk about, you know, some of your projects, and then I want to go back to Sammy Davis Jr. and
okay.
Nina Simone, cuz like,
and
you
Nina
know,
Simone.
you're an insider.
Thank you.
Yeah, like right. So I want you to tell us some stories. But I want you to talk about, you know, Stand for Diabetes. That's a great commercial that you have on your website.
Thank you. Well, Stand for Diabetes, I was diagnosed in 2007. And I didn't know what had happened, you know, what was going on. And I collapsed. And I was with my daughter. She said, Dad, she started saying, Dad, you're hitting all pressures. You know, I said, you know, I'm fine. And I collapsed after doing a speech.
Mm-hmm.
And so she takes me to the hospital. This is my baby daughter, Karan.
Mm-hmm.
And so we go in the hospital, and they say, well, you know, if your blood sugar is so high, we'd like you to stay overnight. And so we can, you know, monitor you. And I said, well, you got my shoe, you're my blood. You told me, let me go. They said, no, you gotta stay overnight. Mm-hmm. So I stayed overnight, and I was going doing my thing, you know, and in the hospital. Next morning, they came in, and they said, you got type 2 diabetes. And I said, and I looked at the guy in the bed next to me, and I said, oh, shame, you got type 2 diabetes, because I know they're not talking to me. I'm Ben Vereen, I don't get diabetes. Mm-hmm. They said, no, you got type 2 diabetes. And the thing about it is that, you know, when you don't know, you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so right away the panic jumps in. You know, you hear about amputation and you hear about death and you hear all these things flash through your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And they flash through my mind. You know, oh my God, how am I going to perform? How am I going to be back on stage? How's my life going to be? I'm going to have to be, because I played a character in Webster some years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Where they had the big needles,
yeah.
The guy had to do, you know, the character had to do insulin, and, you know, the characters thought that he was a drug addict because he had his insulin kit.
Right.
And so I'm looking, I'm flashing back on the Webster. I'm saying, oh, my God, I'm having to be shooting up with a needle. People think I'm a junkie. You know, I went this whole thing in my head until I went to my doctor,
mm-hmm.
and he said, no, you can live with this. Mm-hmm. He said, change your eating habits. And he said, what? He said, yeah, just change your eating habits. He said, exercise. That's when I exercised.
Mm-hmm.
He said, and we're going to put you on insulin. He put me on insulin. I said, is that all it is?
Mm-hmm.
Well, change my eating habits, exercise, and insulin? I mean, do my medication? He
mm-hmm.
said, yeah. So I went to a company called Sanofi.
Mm-hmm.
I said, listen, I'm going to get out there and talk to the community and let them know I can get diabetes. And it's such a high rate. At that time, there were 23 million people living with diabetes in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's 26 million. So I want to get on the campaign, and I want to let people know we can beat this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's why I started a website, StandForDiabetes.org,
mm-hmm.
you know, to let people know we can beat this. You know, it's a simple thing. Change the dialogue around. Stop telling yourself that you have a challenge. No, you have an opportunity,
mm-hmm.
an opportunity towards better health. You are not suffering. You're living with diabetes. And once you change your dialogue about it, you'll start doing the things that are right for your body temple, which you've been blessed with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'll stop eating, you know, you'll start eating the proper things for your body. You'll drink more water. You'll exercise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you'll do your medication. If you're on medication, if you're on insulin, do your insulin.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And you can live a good life with it. And if America would take the regimen of people living with diabetes to exercise more, eat the proper foods, we'd have a healthier country.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We have, like, I mean, we're from 23 to 26 million people in this country now living with diabetes.
Yeah.
And if we look at our young people, the obesity
mm-hmm.
is off the charts.
Yeah.
So I have to get out there. I have to get out there for my young people and for the health of the people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been given this for a reason, this diabetes. I've been giving it for a reason, not to sit back and feel sorry for myself, but to get into the battle
mm-hmm.
and run front, head on, and say, we can defeat this
yeah.
as a people when we come consciously together and stop being the people. I feel like people live with diabetes like it's like us, a Dr. Seuss's The Who.
Mm.
You know, we're the WHO. The people living with diabetes are like the WHO. Nobody knows we're here. We're screaming the American Diabetes are out there. Everyone's doing it. Conferences and everything. There's TOYC, which is also a company that I went to. I said, you've got to help me get the message out there. And I teamed up with them. And, you know, and they're out there. But how many people know about it? Then we say, we wonder why our country is feeling ill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the information. We got to turn the dialogue around. As soon as a person gets, and yes, amputee happens. I'm not negating that the terrible, horrible things happen. Yes, amputee happens. Yes, death will happen. Yes, all these horrible things happen. But here's the good news.
Mm-hmm.
If we turn our consciousness around, we could do something about it in our lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
You know, and we'll save our children. We'll save our tomorrow, our generation. Will diabetes will go away in our lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely can.
It can.
It really can. I mean, there are certain types of diabetes that really can go away. And like
yeah.
you said, it's you know, what you eat and also your attitude, and the exercise is so important because
important.
It has to do with circulation. And a
exactly.
lot of times the amputation happens because we're not moving enough.
Exactly, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and those people living with type 1, you know, I love this story where this kid talks about the fact that, you know, he wouldn't go out because of the fact that he had to take his insulin, and he had type 1.
Mm-hmm.
He saw his team type 1, and they were cycling guys who cycle around team type 1. They're amazing. And he saw them on TV, and he told his mother, he said, Mom, I'm going to go to the park. She said, you sure? He said, yeah. He went to the park, and he's sitting there, and he had to take his insulin shot. check his blood sugar. Mm-hmm. And the kid from across the park saw him mm-hmm. and came running over. And he looked and he said, "You have diabetes?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "I have diabetes too." Because of the fact that he came out, mm-hmm. it was not ashamed that he had to check his blood sugar. Mm-hmm. Another kid who had to check his blood sugar became, you know, okay with it.
Right.
And I want to get into the school system. I want to get into the young people.
Mm-hmm.
Those kids who are living in school with diabetes, they should be supported and become examples of good health.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have to exercise, they have to eat the proper foods,
right.
and they've got to do their insulin if they're on insulin.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It
yeah.
sounds simple to me. You want a healthier country, it sounds mm-hmm. simple to me.
Right, yeah, and it sort of goes right into a lot of our schools having, you know, gardens for the children, so they're growing
mm-hmm.
good, they're growing
exactly.
fresh food
exactly.
and eating more vegetables.
Mm-hmm. We need to embrace that.
Yeah.
We need to embrace that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because a lot of, you know, the diabetes comes from not having fresh food, you know, eating
exactly.
a lot of processed food. And
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, Dr. Oz has a group called Health Corps.
Mm.
You know, which I'm partnering with,
uh-huh.
you know, because they are in the school system.
Mm.
And when you're getting kids to think about health better, you know, better health.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I was just thinking as you were talking that, you know, you use, you know, these potentially, you know, heartbreaking or negative news, you know, as an opportunity.
Yes, exactly. Because what happens is when you fill out the negative and you try to frighten people, you know, you try to frighten them. Oh, you're going to have diabetes. And you're going to take your leg. Oh, and all these horror stories. Instead of telling them, you can live with this.
Mm-hmm.
You can live with this. All you got to do is exercise more. All you got to do is your medication, if you're on medication,
mm-hmm.
and watch what you eat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have to eat all that sugar.
Right.
You know, you don't have to eat the whole cake and be a slice of it, a thin slice. You don't have to get the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Be moderate.
You know?
Yeah.
Moderation. and with the obesity today with young people,
mm-hmm.
we got a job on our hands.
Mm-hmm.
A big job to make
yeah.
our country healthier
mm-hmm.
and make the world a healthier place.
Right.
Not
right.
just America, it's the world.
Mm-hmm.
26 million in America, 7 million who are living with it and don't even know they have it. And every 21 seconds, somebody else is diagnosed with diabetes.
It's a lot
of
people.
We've got a job ahead of us.
Yeah, certainly.
But we can do this. We can do this.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And then, you know, they...
Tell them to go to my website, stanfordiabetes.org.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Stan, S-T-A-N-D for diabetes,
yes.
definitely. Yeah, and also there have been some alternative treatments, like, you know, the raw food diet
exactly.
has really helped, you know,
exactly.
some people like not even need insulin
exactly.
or need less medicine. Oh, for real?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm a vegetarian. I raised my hand.
Oh, wow.
I'm a member.
That is so awesome.
Mm-hmm. But
wow.
that's my choice.
Mm-hmm.
That's
yeah.
my choice. It might not be the choice of that person who's living with diabetes mm-hmm. next door.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They may need something else for their diet. I'm not saying that my choice is my decision to be, you know, eat, you know, vegetarian or raw is right. It's right for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Hmm. So, are you gonna come out with a cookbook after you come out with your memoir?
Probably so.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah, because I was trying raw. I think I've been raw for like about a month, 6 weeks, and I'm gonna have to just be vegan right at the moment because I don't know how to cook enough, and I've been hungry.
Uh-huh.
I gotta...
You know, yeah, but there are cookbooks that are, you know, preparing books.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a whole school.
I know. I'd rather just hire somebody. Just come in and cook my meals for the
yes,
week.
Yes, there you go.
Fix my meals for the week.
You know, well, that's what I do. I don't really prepare my foods. I go to it's a vegan restaurant around the corner. I get me a week's supply of food and I'm fine.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
when I'm on the road, you know, and see, being on the road is another thing.
Mm.
Because on the road, you can't find, you know, the foods that I eat in everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So I eat a lot of salads. You know, I choose what I choose, you know, to eat.
Yes.
And I usually carry what I need with me.
Mm-hmm.
That's my choice. That's my choice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to get your own.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I found when I was traveling, like when I go out of the country,
mm-hmm.
one of my suitcases just has food, like
uh-huh,
exactly. nuts and
mm-hmm.
supplements
exactly.
and this
exactly.
and that.
Yes, because when I fly, I tell them when I fly, I say, you know, give me a vegan plate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when I have a chance to order, that's what I do. My daughter takes my nuts, and I take, you know, my food that I eat.
Yeah.
You know? I look at the person next door, and they got all that. That's for their choice of their life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not judging anybody.
Right.
What's right for me is right for me. What's right for them is right for them. Let's all get up the mountaintop together. Don't hurt nobody on the way.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right.
Don't kick anybody off the mountaintop.
Right. No, there's room for all of us, that's for sure.
Exactly. Exactly.
Wow. So tell us about some of your, you know, your mentors and folks
Frank, all the boys, you know, Nina Simone and, you know, and all those people, Diana Ross, Calma McRae.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Those are people I grew up on, you know, Etta James.
Wow.
Ray Charles.
Yeah.
Wow. The list goes on and on and on and on. Yeah. Matter of fact, right across the street from me, had I known when I was a child, I'd have paid a little bit more attention, but it was a shoeshine parlor.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, you had the Blue Law in Brooklyn, right? Uh-huh. That meant there was no alcohol on Sunday.
Oh, wow.
All the liquor stores shut down. So all the deacons from the churches would line up at Tip Tap and Toe to get their shoes shined. I used to find that strange until I found out that Tip Tap and Toe was a vaudeville act. And they used to tap dance while they would shine shoes.
Yeah.
And they'd pop their rags and they put on a show, you know, for the deacons when they came in to get their shoes shined, and they served them little Dixie cups. And I thought it was water, but it was liquor.
Oh, the deacons had liquor on the Blue Sunday?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They'd stack up on liquor, you know, on a Friday and Saturday. And put it in the back. And then they'd sell little Dixie cups or shots of liquor before the deacons with the church.
Whoa.
Well, they got their shoes shined, but they would put on a show. They'd pop their rags and they would dance. And those kids would press our nose up against the window and watch them in awe. They'd play jazz and they'd dance to catch like that, you know?
Wow, that's really cool.
Well, I've had people like that in my life. You know, I've had a man, you know, Flip Wilson, my God.
Yeah.
You know, Jimmy Slide. And, you know, I've had some amazing people touch my life. You know, Sandman Sims used to travel around with me, trying to show me how to tap. I'm a jazz dancer. You know?
Yeah.
Like he would travel around with me. I mean, these are amazing. Trainers. Whew. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. You know?
Wow.
Della Reese. Della Reese. I just went to her house the other day.
Oh, yeah. She was here at the Razz Room.
Yes, I love Della.
She is,
you know,
wonderful.
Matter of fact, she gave me a script. She wants me to work on a director for her. You know, so I'm working on that. You know, people have touched my lives. Nancy Wilson.
Oh,
you know, Jim,
really?
Jimmy Smith. My God. Come on. You know? Jesus.
Oh,
little, I mean, amazing. Amazing. Kenneth James.
Yeah. Wow.
I mean, the legacy goes on and on. You know, the Temptations, the OJs. Oh, man. You know, the Trineers, as I said. You know, and I came to Vegas. I saw, I mean, and it was, I was opening for a guy named Alan King. And prior to that, there was a guy named Buster Keaton. And they had a big, huge fan on the stage at Caesar's Palace, and he just stand there and lean into the wind. That was his act. Oh, it was hysterical. Chubby Checker was right across the street. And this is a little kid from Brooklyn, my first time in Vegas when it was a desert. When Vegas was Vegas. Now it's, you know, Disneyland for adults. You know, in those days it was Vegas. And I'd just hang out with these guys. We'd sit around the table. And I'd sit around, I was playing the Riviera, and I'd sit around the table, and it was Bill Cosby, Richard Pryor, Chickie Green, there was Flip Wilson, there was Don Rickles. And they'd be sitting around trying to out-joke each other. And they'd start at like 4 and 5 in the morning, and they'd be there till 10 o'clock, and your sides would be hurting. Hurting.
Wow.
You know, this is the legacy that I come from. You know, Sammy Davis.
Yeah.
My God, Sammy, you know. Oh, God, he touched my life. Oh, he touched my life. You know, we met on the set of, I met him in Vegas. I tell the story in my act. But we met in Vegas. And he once said, you know, if you want to get this business, come talk to me. And then we met again on the set of Sweet Charity.
Right.
But then he took me to London with him. And that's when I found my family, of course. But, you know, we went to London. We did Golden Boy in London. And hanging out with him was an amazing, amazing, amazing journey.
Yeah.
So I've been really blessed. I've had some wonderful people in my life. The list goes on and on and on and on. When I was in high school, I went to a school called the Ernest Johnson's Dance School. And Bernice Johnson one day said, I want to take my dance troupe over to Pittsburgh. And we're going to do the first Pittsburgh Jazz Festival. Mary Lou Williams put it on.
Mary Lou Williams?
And on the show was Dakota Staton, Jimmy Smith, Thelonious Monk, Harold Getters, and the list goes on, Joe Williams. And he was at Mom's Mabley.
Oh.
And I'm in the wings watching these cats.
Yeah.
I'm like blown away. I mean, it was amazing. Some Dakota Staton. Whew. Oh, that's a legacy I come from.
So wonder you're so great. You've got, like, all these models. Like, okay, well, you know what greatness is.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, because I just think about our young folks. Mm-hmm. The reason why they don't live up to their potential is because they don't know who they are. Because if they knew who they were, they would say, oh, this is beneath me. I can't do that.
Well, we don't teach them that, do we?
No.
No, we teach them how to make a living instead of how to live.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
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 Wow. And Red Fox.
Red Fox. Oh God. Yes. Red Fox, Chucky Green, all those guys.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Wow. So have things gotten easier for you?
Pig Meat Markham.
Oh, for real? Wow.
Yeah. I told you, Mom's Mabley.
Yeah.
There was this gorgeous woman walked into the Pittsburgh Jazz Festival.
Mm-hmm.
She was gorgeous.
Mm.
And she walks into her room and Mom's Mabley walks out.
Oh, man.
Now, that'll blow your mind.
Mm.
This gorgeous woman walks in, and then she goes in the room and gets into this character and walks out as Mom's Mabley.
Mm. Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Flip Wilson,
mm-hmm.
you know, as I said, you know.
Yeah.
Garfield Cambridge.
Oh, wow.
You know, all these cats, you know. I knew all these guys.
Mm.
Brock Peters,
mm.
you know. I knew all these cats. And, of course, Gregory Hines, as I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
The Hines brothers. Hines, and Dad.
Mm.
You
mm-hmm.
know. These are all the guys that I grew up under.
Yeah.
You know, watching
wow.
these guys.
Mm.
Just blown away. And I wasn't in the theater. You know, the first show I did was a show called The Prodigal Son.
Mm-hmm.
Out of high school.
Uh-huh.
It was directed by a woman named Vinette Carroll. I don't know if you know her.
Mm-hmm.
She's an African-American woman. And she directed a show called Your Arms Are Too Short, The Boxing
Ball. Oh, yeah. That's famous.
She did The Prodigal
Son.
And one day I was leaving the theater, and this guy walks up to me and he says, where's the men's dressing room? And I said, well, it's back there. And he looked at me and said, oh, he says, by the way, he says, you're Benjamin Vereen, aren't you? I said, yeah. He said, well, my name is Langston Hughes. He said, can I buy you dinner? And we became good friends.
Langston Hughes? Are you serious?
Langston Hughes.
Oh, my God.
He invited me up to his place in Harlem, and he sat there and he gave me two of his books, I Wonder As I Wander and The Big Sea.
Oh.
And he told me stories.
His travel books.
Yes. Langston Hughes.
Oh, my
yes,
God.
Yes.
Oh. Do you still have the books?
Oh, yes.
Oh, wow.
Yes, I do.
My God.
Matter of fact, my daughter collects all my stuff because I'm traveling so much. She just holds on to things. She's
that's
a collector.
Good.
She's a filmmaker, Karan.
Oh.
So she holds on to things for me, you know. So, you know, she and my grandson, they live with me now, so I'm excited about that.
Oh, my God. Langston Hughes.
Langston Hughes, yes.
Oh, did you know James Baldwin, too?
Excuse me?
Did you know James Baldwin, too?
Oh, yes. James Baldwin and I sat together in Paris. Where was it? It was the south of France.
When Nina Simone lived, too, in south of France.
Yes, it was. And I was in a club, and George Shearing and James Baldwin, we were all sitting at the table. That was the night that Princess Grace came to see my show at the Sportsman's Club.
Wow.
And I was flying home, and I was flying from France back to the United States, and I read the paper. That's when she came to see me, and she died.
Oh.
She had that accident, Princess Grace.
Yeah.
And I did a show called The Night of 100 Stars. I don't give me a lot of stuff. I mean, I'm just getting diarrhea of the mouth now. You open a floodgate now. But I did a show called The Night of 100 Stars.
Mm-hmm.
Alex Cohen. wanted to have 100 stars on the stage at Radio City. He got over 200 different
wow,
stars.
Nice.
I mean, I'm walking around, and, you know, people say, you know, I'm hearing, hi, Ben. And I'm in the elevator, and there's Paul Newman and you know, and Joanne Woodworth and Sammy Davis, Frank Sinatra, mm-hmm. and there's Lon Chaney. There's, you know, there's Douglas Fairbanks Jr., you know, and